This is Jeffrey Sachs, editor of Tradition. I always look forward to bringing you the Tradition podcast and all of our weekly digital contents. But I'm also hoping that you'll subscribe to Tradition to get everything that we have to offer in our print journal. Becoming a subscriber is the only way to make sure you don't miss the best writing in the Orthodox Jewish world on the most timely and timeless topics. Visit traditiononline.org to get delivery of the quarterly journal and digital access to all the content in our archives, from our founding in 1958 right up to our most recent issue. That's over six decades of our community's most incisive, impactful, and reflective writing and scholarship. Rav Zalman Nechemia Goldberg Zatzal, who passed away in Israel just over a year ago at the age of 89, was a towering rabbinic authority who provided halakhic guidance to Jews throughout the world on a vast array of contemporary issues. He possessed a unique blend of phenomenal erudition and real-world wisdom. One of his legendary traits was to apply the intricacies of halakhic discourse to the practical world of contemporary dispute resolution in the Jewish community. In so doing, he brought traditional lumdus down to earth. To help readers gain an appreciation of his sense of practical halacha in the context of the modern Beit Din, Tradition's Fall 2021 issue features a translation of his important essay, Shivchei HaPshara, about the many practical advantages of deciding cases according to principles of equity and compromise, the standard utilized by many rabbinical courts today, and not simply according to strict halacha or din. This essay is an excellent introduction to understanding Rav Zalman Nechemia's halachic thought and offers insight to the mind and heart of one of our generation's most significant halachists. Subscribers have received the issue containing the article and can access it on traditiononline.org. But since In Praise of Pshara is somewhat technical in nature, we invited Rav Yonah Ries and Rav Daniel Z. Feldman of Tradition's editorial board to discuss it, unpack its ideas and terminology, and enable greater understanding of the issues. As you'll hear, they also describe their own personal connections with Rav Zalman Nechemia and how this essay reflects larger themes in his worldview and jurisprudence. Rabbi Daniel Z. Feldman is a Rosh Yeshiva at the Rabbi Isaac Elchanan Theological Seminary, an instructor in the Sisim School of Business and the Wurzweiler School of Social Work at Yeshiva University, and is the rabbi of Or Sadia in Teaneck, New Jersey. He has authored 9 volumes on Jewish law and thought, most recently, False Facts and True Rumors, Lashon Hara in Contemporary Culture. Rabbi Yonah Ries is the Av Beit Din of the Chicago Rabbinical Council and also a Rosh Yeshiva at Ritz. He is the author of Kanfei Yonah, a collection of essays and responsa about contemporary issues in Jewish law and Beit Din practice. We're particularly grateful to Rabbi Ries for his role in bringing this essay to Tradition's readers. And now, let's eavesdrop on their chavruta as they discuss Rav Zalman Nechemia Goldberg's In Praise of Pshara.
Good evening, Rabbi Ries. I was very fascinated to read this article from Rav Zalman Nechemia Goldberg, whose memory we so cherish, and I thank you for bringing it to publication in Tradition. It was really very eye-opening, and I know that Pshara is a topic that's greatly misunderstood, and very often I know I hear from congregants sometimes that they are afraid to go to Beis Din because they think Beis Din is going to push them into a compromise that they think they don't need to make. They think they're right. Why should they be forced to compromise? They hear that Beis Din is all about Pshara. And it's very valuable to have an article like this, which helps frame Pshara in a way that people can appreciate. And it's the very title, In Praise of Pshara, calling attention to why it's a system that, through the discussion of the Gemara, with the back and forth, and through the ruling in the Shulchan Aruch, we have come to embrace in our Beis Din culture. And I know that you, as with your extensive experience in Beis Din and with your interactions with Rav Zalman Nechemia himself, can particularly appreciate just how much his personality and his knowledge and his experience comes out in this particular piece.
Yes, and thank you for that introduction. I was always very interested in the practical aspects of the Beis Din world, which is probably why I got involved in the Beis Din universe myself. And Rav Zalman Nechemya Goldberg was always a guiding light for me and for many other Dayanim in terms of his deciphering all of the lumdus of many Choshen Mishpat discussions and bringing it down to earth, so to speak, in terms of prescribing very practical parameters through which one can apply all of the principles that we learn in Choshen Mishpat in a very practical sense in the real world of Dinei Torah. And this is no exception in terms of the format of this article, which, as you mentioned, is entitled Shivchei HaPshara, in praise of Pshara. And I think that Rav Zalman Nechemya was really describing several aspects of the praise of Pshara. One, as you pointed out, that the Gemara has multiple opinions regarding what it describes as whether it's a mitzvah lipsoa, whether it's a mitzvah lipsoa. Sounds like you're kind of breaking things up a little bit. Or you're kind of carving out from what would otherwise be the stricter judgment some type of a resolution which might not be 100% in accordance with the strict law, but it's going to lead to a more peaceful resolution, what we typically refer to as a pshara, which is very much a part of the Din Torah process. And one opinion says it's a mitzvah lipsoa. Another opinion says it's also lipsoa, that there's some sort of a prohibition involved. Meaning sometimes, for sure, it's a bad idea if we use the term of carving away at what the strict justice should be. So we know that one example of that is with respect to the sale of Yosef. And when Yehuda said, "Ma betzah ki naroges achino, l'chuvenim parentally yishmeilim," what betzah is it going to be if we're going to kill our brother? Let's go and sell him. The Gemara says, in terms of working out a pshara, not such a great pshara. It was a bad thing to kill Yosef. It was also a bad thing to sell Yosef. That it's not always ideal to make a compromise. And maybe that's what that opinion is getting at. You have to be circumspect. And then there's the opinion, it's a reshus, it's permissive, it's permissible to make a pshara. And we really paskin, as Rav Zalman Nechemya's article is entitled, Shivchei HaPshara, we think it's a good thing, meaning we tilt it towards the opinion of Rabbi Yeshua ben Korcha in the Gemara and Sanhedrin, that it's a mitzvah, it really is proper, it's something which is encouraged to make a pshara. But at the same time, you have to really know what you're doing. And that's why the Shulchan Aruch and the Mefarshim all point out that just like a judge is not allowed to pervert a strict judgment that's being rendered according to din, according to a regular judgment, so too there's such a thing as perverting a judgment that's decided in accordance with pshara, in accordance with these principles of equity or compromise, if you will, that there's a right way of doing it, there's a wrong way of doing it. The Ramah talks about that there's no kfiyah that's allowed. You're not allowed to impose either a pshara or impose what we call the lifnim mishuras hadin, to decide a case that for the parties to agree that the judges will be allowed to decide the case above and beyond the letter of the law. Really the way in which the preference towards pshara is manifested is by presenting the option to the parties that you say, "Adina temotsimo pshara, would you like to adjudicate the case according to strict law, or would you like to do it according to pshara?" And we generally assume, like the Sma says, that we're pushing it. We're pushing it, but we're not compelling it. If the parties say to us, no, we want everything to be according to strict justice, so theoretically, they have that right to do it. So that's sort of the starting point. The Shivkei Apshara means it's a good thing. The Gemara says it's a good thing. It's a mitzvah. But it also means we have to convince you that it's a good thing. We have to we have to cajole the parties into agreeing to give the best in that type of authority that it could decide the case according to compromise, not according to the strict letter of the law. And the other important thing that Rezam Nechemya does is that he doesn't just treat this as a theoretical abstract concept, but he gives you practical applications of what does it mean in the real world that you have the ability to exercise a type of judgment, a type of Bezdin adjudication that's not according to strict law. And he points out that it's both substantive and procedural in nature, that procedurally it means that you don't have to necessarily exercise the same standard of evidence, that from an evidentiary perspective, if you would have some type of a standard through which we would say that from a halakhic perspective, and we'll see in Mammon al pi rov, that if there's just a majority of of an argument that would benefit the plaintiff, and the plaintiff would not be able to prevail without two kosher witnesses, for example, who are substantiating his claim. In this context, Pshara, we can be more lenient that if we have strong circumstantial evidence, that we would render a favorable judgment for the plaintiff, potentially, in the event that we're talking about Pshara. And on a substantive level, very often there's a claim that's brought where the damages are consequential. They're not direct damages, they're indirect damages, where we say that a person is potter bidei Adam and the chayav bidei b'dinei Shemayim. A person is exempt from having to pay damages because it's not direct according to the laws of man, but it would be responsible according to the laws of heaven. Normally, a Bezdin does not get to award judgment based on the laws of heaven, but if it's a Pshara type of proceeding, so then Bezdin could have the latitude, if this is what's just under the circumstances, to issue such a judgment. So these are some of the discussions that Rav Zalman Nechemya includes in his article. He also tries to give some of the sources as to where we see that you can bend the judgment a little bit. The Gemara in Bava Metzia and Daf Mem Beis, it seems to provide some sort of a basis for what's a common best in practice of bending the judgment up to, say, one third of what otherwise would have been awarded if the plaintiff would have gotten everything. So for the sake of Pshara, maybe you can deduct one third if the defendant would have been completely, if the defendant would have been completely exonerated, but there is some basis from an equitable perspective to require him to pay something. So maybe you could require him to pay up to one third. So he gives you some of the conceptual underpinnings as well, which all in all provides for a good base and a good framework for someone to just have a greater appreciation as to why it is that the rabbis say that Pshara is a good thing, because it enables us to look at the bigger picture, rather than being very harsh or too harsh, either in one direction or in the other direction. And it gives a greater sense of latitude as well to consider certain claims and certain types of evidence that are more realistic in terms of what, on a practical level, Bezdin has to deal with in the caseload and the type of evidentiary data that is going to typically be presented in any case that comes in front of the Bezdin. As with everything that Rav Zalman Nechemya wrote, there's a lot of alumnus, so a lot of back and forth in terms of considering all of the angles, pro and con, of everything that he presents. But that's because he was a wellspring of ideas and thoughts and very intensive Talmudic deliberation. And one of the other advantages of this piece is that you get to see that sense of intellectual thoroughness and intellectual honesty from Rav Zalman Nechemya as well.
And I think a part of what you're emphasizing here is when he makes a point and he draws these various distinctions between how din would play out and how pshara would play out, the reason these aren't simply neutral distinctions, but they are reasons to prefer pshara, is because they present a more complete picture of what real justice is, and that allow a conclusion that really reflects what should be, and not simply what might be impacted by the limitations of law, where there are going to be rules that are going to tie our hands a little bit. But pshara allows for things to take place that otherwise couldn't, that maybe are more conducive to a just result.
Yeah, it's always this conundrum, because the pasuk in Zechariah says, "Emes u'mishpat shalom shiftu b'sha'areichem." You should have mishpat, you should have justice, but you should also have shalom. You should also have harmony. And the Gemara says, well, if you have strict justice, sometimes you have just a complete victory or complete loss, and it could lead to discord and bad feelings, particularly if the person who lost had a little bit of an equitable argument in their favor. And maybe it would have led to a more just result in some long-term type of picture if it wouldn't have been just a 100% judgment, you know, in favor or against particular parties. So that's really one of the major sources, according to the Gemara, Ezu Mishpat Shu Shalom. What's the type of Mishpat that also comes with Shalom? This is pshara. It's you have to realize you're dealing with parties who are going to very often continue to have dealings with each other, and even dealings with other people too. It's important to recognize the benefit and the value of giving in a little bit and having a sense of appreciation for the other person's position. Sometimes even pshara is going to dictate that the decision will be 100% that the plaintiff gets everything, or 100% that the plaintiff gets nothing, because even the equitable considerations lead to that result. But in many cases, that's not the case. Now, people are sometimes under the misimpression that pshara means that you always split the baby in half. But the Gemara says that that's not called pshara. That's called Dayani Chatzatzta. Imam Baba Basra says, Dayani Chatzatzta, the judges who think that the way you resolve every case is you just split everything 50% down the middle, and that's how you reach an equitable result. So one of the benefits of Zalman Nechemya's analysis is illustrating that pshara is much more nuanced and much more complex than that. Every single case has to be evaluated according to its merits. And as you said, it means you have to really look at the bigger picture. You know, obviously the definition of pshara itself is one which Chazal really leave open to a certain degree to figure out what does it mean. So some just define it as compromise. That's the idea. Bitsua, you're chipping away a little bit to reach a more harmonious result. Sometimes pshara is defined more in terms of yosher, that you're looking at all of the equitable considerations. Rav Soloveitchik, you might want to, you know, elaborate upon this, because I know that you've written on this subject. Rav Soloveitchik liked to talk about pshara in the context of yosher, the famous, you know, comment that Rashi has on the pasuk by Sisa Yosher Atov B'nei Hashem. So he just quotes a zu pshara lifnim mishura sadin. He has a continuum is pshara. It's lifnei mishura sedin. What's lifnei mishura sedin? That means going above and beyond the letter of the law, which many people will translate as yosher. It means you're just doing what's the right thing under the circumstances. So you'll find that some dayanim in their minds distinguish between the two concepts. It's pshara on the one hand, is yosher on the other hand. I think that from Rav Soloveitchik's perspective, it's all hainu hach. It's one thing. You look at the Rashi. He doesn't have a above in our girsos of Rashi. It's pshara lifnei mishura sedin. It's one continuum this is something that we push. The Gemara in Bava Metzia quotes Rabbi Yochanan as saying, "Lochavi Yushlaim al shadanu din Torah." Yushlaim was destroyed because they adjudicated cases according to din Torah. So the Gemara says, well, what were they supposed to do? Use some sort of a sorcerer's handbook in order to adjudicate cases? So the Gemara answers, no. The problem was that they decided that they're going to be done according to strict law, but they wouldn't go above and beyond the letter of the law in terms of resolving their disputes. And that was a big mistake. Because the viability of our civil society depends upon people really being mevater, giving up a little bit of what they think they're strictly entitled to in order to bring about a greater sense of harmony, a greater sense of equity, and ultimately a greater sense of justice as well.
Yeah, it's a fascinating concept, as you know, and as Rav Soloveitchik did discuss in his shiurim, and I did have the privilege many years ago to work on preparing some of those shiurim about this subject specifically, and Rav Soloveitchik would note the extent to which pshara was linked with strict din, and yet was also distinct from straight din. So it had the rules of the general standards and requirements you mentioned before, about how there is a prohibition of hatayas adin by pshara also. You can't try to push it in one way or the other. But at the same time, it had certain distinct qualities. So, for example, Tosfos and Sanhedrin asserting that even though when it comes to a din Torah, we follow a majority among the judges, we would follow the opinion of two out of three judges. But when it comes to pshara, we'd have to have three unanimous judges. And the Rav suggested that there is a difference between pshara and din, in that in the case of din, we're dealing more abstractly and we're trying to assess what would a halacha be that would be applicable in this case and every other similar case that would come down the pike. And therefore, in establishing a halachic principle, you could have a majority vote and we would follow the majority. But here, every circumstance is unique and whatever is going to apply to the case in front of us is not going to apply to any other case. And therefore, the standard of Rove is not going to fit as well as it would by a more abstract din. It had to be something tailored to this particular case in front of us, and that's what's being addressed. But at the same time, it would emphasize that that is still a din. And like you noted before, it's certainly not just splitting down the middle. And he would also argue that the translation that we use casually of compromise, it really isn't the appropriate translation. It's not a compromise, and that's a little bit what I think some of our community members are afraid of, that they imagine that it's going to be just splitting down the middle, that it's just a compromise. I say you owe me $100, you say you owe me nothing, okay, so they'll say make it $50. So that type of attitude is a concern to those who are trying to get a just treatment of their dispute. And that's where Soloveitchik emphasized, it's not about that at all. As you pointed out, it could end up in 100-0, depending on what exactly are the facts and the relevant elements of the case. But it's about factoring in certain considerations that wouldn't necessarily be brought into a strict din procedure. And it's about what he called, as you noted, a psak shalasnim mishuritah din, a ruling that is not bound only to the din, but also to lifnim mishuritah din, which we understand as incorporating everything that makes it just and fair and peaceful. And he also highlighted the role of kinyan, the debate in the Gemara where there has to be a kinyan in order to proceed with pshara. And the conclusion is that there is a need for a kinyan, even though Zalman Chaim, the article, points out it depends on what kind of situation we're talking about. But the Rav explained what the purpose of the kinyan there was, that on the one hand, there may be some degree of sacrificing one's rights, and therefore that required a particular commitment that may be distinct from that which was necessary in the context of din. But he also noted that if it was about committing yourself to whatever number they come up with, so that's something that a Kenyan wouldn't really work for, because you have no way of knowing what that number is going to be. It would be a problem of a smach, it would be a problem of a commitment that may not really come from full awareness and full agreement. So he went on to explain that it's about committing to the judgment of the Dayan in front of you and understanding that what they come to with their focus on a complete 360 picture of din and justice and mechnimishur sedin is something that you're willing as a litigant to commit to and to come to with a full sense of appreciation for what that can result in. And that's what the Kenyan is meant to accomplish, your commitment to this process of mechnimishur sedin, which is really a very beautiful idea. You know, the Achronim discuss whether there is an aspect of matana here, somebody giving up his rights, just some kind of a gift, or is there perhaps an aspect of mecher, there's a sale here because you're getting a complete shalom out of it, so it's worth it for that. But it's an interesting philosophical consideration that also has practical implications of how to view this whole idea of pshara, but certainly recognizing that it brings about not just justice, but justice that has this aspect of shalom, and that really comes to a conclusion that is most reflective of the Ratzon HaBore and the needs both of the Torah as a system and of people as human beings interacting with each other. And also add that when they read this article reflecting Rav Zalman Chemid's own preferences and his own sensitivities, and I know you had many interactions with him and I had more limited interactions with him, but the personality that emerged always, he was a Dayan, certainly not a Dayan in the standard sense, a Dayan who had a sense of achrayus for Klal Yisrael all at once. You know, his involvement in situations such as the 9/11 Aguna cases, and also in working on the prenuptial agreement together with the Beit Willig, he had a sense of responsibility as a Dayan that went beyond any normal situation in front of him. It was very Klal Yisrael mentality, but also it was not just in his role as Dayan, his role as a teacher of Torah and as an enabler of Torah and as a mentor. He was somebody, we know he gave that smicha to so many. He had felt a sense of responsibility for training and for creating Rabbanim, and I was able to receive a haskama from him. And he wrote many, many haskamas, and the haskamas always reflected a real knowledge of what was in the safe. He was involved in giving of his time with a phenomenal generosity and sense of responsibility for Klal Yisrael, and a sense of what could he do with his phenomenal talents and knowledge and commitment to bring about a maximization of Torah in the world. And it's realization in so many different facets. His willingness to travel all over, to give shiurim all over the country on a bus, and he's going from place to place. And his incredible wellspring of knowledge was certainly something that was astounding, but his willingness to apply that knowledge to the benefit of Klal Yisrael with such self-sacrifice and such a sense of commitment, and this desire to make sure that Torah, teaching Torah, living Torah, was realized to the greatest extent possible, and that as one man, he would do as much as he could to bring that about. It was really a phenomenal thing to witness and to experience.
Yeah, I think Rav Zalman Nechemia, he always had the grand picture in mind in terms of everything that he did, in terms of what's going to be best for Klal Yisrael. How could you take the principles of Torah and use it in order to resolve contemporary situations in the best possible fashion? He advised the Beis Din of America with respect to the prenuptial agreement. So when there was a concern that you had an aguna problem on the one end, but you had a problem that many of the women who were going through divorce cases, who were the same women who were being deprived of their get in many situations by recalcitrant husbands, didn't have a trust of the Beis Din system to adjudicate all facets of the divorce. And Rezalman Nechemya felt that you could really resolve both problems together in terms of the same structure of having an arbitration agreement in terms of a viable prenuptial agreement that would require both the husband and the wife, if there was ever a breakdown of the marriage, to submit to the authority of the Beis Din in a way that would be binding not only as a matter of halacha, but also as a matter of a secular law. And at the same time, would also encourage the parties to adjudicate not only the issue of the get in front of the Beis Din, but also to adjudicate all matters of the divorce in front of the Beis Din, so that you could really have a situation of la'agdil toiro la'adira to restore a teres hatara le'yoshna. It's that there be a respect for the entire system of Beis Din. And he suggested that if there were women who had a problem with the way in which the strict Torah law divided the monetary assets at the conclusion of a marriage so that they would feel more comfortable adjudicating it in civil court. So he said there's nothing wrong with inserting a clause in the prenuptial agreement that the Beis Din will adjudicate the monetary matters in accordance with the civil law. That you can make a Tanai Shibamomon when it comes to monetary matters, as opposed to matters of ritual prohibition, like the charging of interest. But when it comes to monetary matters, how money is going to be divided between two partners, how money is going to be divided at the conclusion of a marriage between husband and wife, absolutely nothing wrong with stipulating that it's going to be done in accordance with customary principles that may be consistent with secular law adjudication of divorce cases in accordance with, say, principles of equitable distribution and the like. And Rezalman Nechemya published a number of articles justifying this advice that he gave to the Beis Din of America, because there were detractors and there were critics, and he explained why this made sense from a halakhic perspective. The wonderful thing about Rezalman Nechemya is that he was able to maintain his eyes on the big picture while going about that the big picture application in a manner of really getting down to the nuts and bolts of the halacha, because he was also very detail-oriented in terms of the nuts and bolts of every single halachic discussion. You see that certainly here in this article, with all the technicalities of the article, which we acknowledge is not sort of your typical tradition type of piece that appears in this journal, but is one which is important for just illustrating the detail-oriented approach of Rezalman Nechemya towards resolving broader societal issues. And the fact that he was always available for everybody is, you know, something I experienced myself in my early days of working at the Beis Din. I had a very vexing question that related to the signing of witnesses on a get and the way that a particular name was signed and whether it was the kosher, whether it wasn't kosher. And as a young dayan, I was very, very nervous because you know that when it comes to a get, even the slightest mistake could create a problem of a woman remaining an Eishes Ish, remaining a married woman according to halakha, mamzeiros problems, God forbid, you know, down the road. And I wrote a very, very long shaila to Rezalman Nechemya. I wrote it out by hand. This is before I learned how to type in Hebrew. So I wrote it out in longhand, and I faxed it to Rezalman Nechemya. Then I faxed a supplement to Rezalman Nechemya. I had a lot of sources and so forth. I wanted to, you know, be very thorough and cover all the bases. And one afternoon, I happened to be in my apartment. I wasn't normally there at that time, but it just happened, the timing-wise, it worked out. The telephone rings, and it's Rezalman Nechemya. I guess I had left the telephone number and the fax number and whatever else, but he called me on my telephone to answer the shaila. It was this very young, very, you know, green dayan in my, you know, early years. And he called me up directly to discuss it with me, to tell me there's nothing to worry about, that the Chasima Sa'idim on a get is with Pnei Tikkun HaOlam, and we have a more lenient standard. But he told me that in this particular case, it was not only kosher b'diyevit, it was kosher l'chatchila, and we could do it again exactly the same way, and it wouldn't be a problem, and gave me all kinds of reassurances. And it was this wonderful, you know, nice conversation that I had. I told a seasoned, more veteran Dayan about this conversation I had with Rav Zalman Nechemia. And he said to me, wow, he never called me up. So I was very honored to have that one-on-one attention from Rav Zalman Nechemia. And Baruch Hashem, we were able to maintain a correspondence during the years that followed. He was always available, always of tremendous help to the Beis Din, in whether with respect to the 9/11 Aguna cases and all kinds of other very interesting shilos that we brought to his attention, where we had the tshuvas that he sent to us that really were able to guide us in terms of how do you evaluate the ksuva bizman hazeh. He wrote a very thoughtful tshuva on that subject that we certainly have relied upon as well. And in this gift that he, you know, left in terms of delineating some of the parameters of exercising pshara bizman hazeh, that certainly is also a source of inspiration and a source of guidance, you know, for us, you know, in terms of how we actually adjudicate cases. Because if you look at the rules and procedures of the Beis Din of America, similarly, the rules and procedures of the Beis Din of the Chicago Rabbinical Council, so we point out that absent to any kind of agreement to the contrary, we adjudicate every single case according to this standard that he advocates in this article, a pshara krova ladin, that you don't abandon the principles, the strict principles of Jewish law. You keep the din aspect. Obviously, we're trained to understand halacha and to apply halacha, but at the same time, there's a din which is mixed together with equity. It's pshara krova ladin. You have a judgment that is justified and that is explained based on traditional halakhic sources, but at the same time, it also takes into account these pshara, these equitable considerations. And that is the standard that we follow in all of our cases. And it's consistent also, I should mention, with the admonition that is contained in the Shulchan Aruch in Siman Yud Beis and Choshen Mishpa, that's tzrichim adayon lisrachik b'chol ha'yecholesh shlo yekablu aleim lodun din Torah. It's based on a Yerushalmi that the dayonim are supposed to stay away as much as possible from adjudicating a case according to strict justice. This becomes, by virtue of it being codified in the Shulchan Aruch, on some level, and almost kind of curiously and paradoxically, it becomes part of the din. Part of our din nowadays is that we say we shouldn't be so arrogant to think that we understand din so perfectly that it's really the proper thing, not only from the perspective of the litigants, but from the perspective of the dayanim as well, to incorporate pshara, to incorporate these considerations into the final judgment that is handed down by the Beis Din. Therefore, it's extremely important to understand how to go about this exercise as responsibly and carefully as possible.
Yeah, that's a very fascinating point. And I think even the way he ends off, that maybe a part of his whole message of why pshara is preferred is that it's not that din and pshara are really so distinct from each other as if they're two different types, completely separate, but that in a sense, pshara is more din than din. It enables a more accurate ruling and a more complete ruling. And that parable he tells towards the end in order to illustrate why the din system itself is more effective than the secular civil law system. It seems like he's saying that pshara is even more of that. Essentially, it takes some of the values of din and takes them even further and essentially realizes them even more.
Yes, and I think that, you know, it's important to note in that vein that the application of pshara in the real world, you know, takes really the form of this adjudication of pshara krova ledin. But it also, in terms of being able to accommodate the realities of the situation, it also incorporates the observation of the Shilte HaGiborim, who notes that in addition to this idea of encouraging the parties to submit to an adjudication that's going to be in accordance with the standard of pshara krova ledin, that there's also a notion of encouraging the parties to reach a settlement on their own between themselves. Even if the Beis Din might be limited in terms of the judgment that we're able to render, even pshara krova ledin has certain limitations. If the parties are sitting down and working out their differences between each other, they really end up having a lot more latitude. And it's a funny thing because this comes up a lot. The Beis Din can hear the entire case. And the halacha is that when the Beis Din issues its final judgment, so then the Beis Din can't backtrack at that point and say, oh, we're going to do a pshara. Once the judgment has been issued, it says ploni atachayev, you know, ploni atapater. So then the case is over. From the Beis Din's perspective, it can't push pshara anymore. But it says the Shilte HaGiborim, no limitation on saying to the parties, but between the two of you, you know, if you want to come up with a more peaceful settlement, so between the two of you, you can reach a settlement on your own. And in every single judgment that we hand down, in order to be consistent with this idea of furthering a peaceful result between the parties, we always say, listen, here's the judgment that we've rendered, but the two of you, you have the complete discretion. You have complete permission to come up with any other settlement that you want to. You're not prohibited, you know, from the perspective of Jewish law of saying, thank you very much for your judgment, but we're going to decide that we're going to reach a separate peaceful settlement between ourselves that's going to work out better in terms of promoting a harmonious relationship. So in every case that comes in front of our Beis Din, we actually only litigate the case in terms of issuing a decision binding upon the parties after we've exhausted efforts at mediating the dispute beforehand. So the administrator of the Beis Din will sit down with the parties, see whether there's room to mediate the dispute. That's another shade of meaning of pshara, of mediation, of being able to mediate, to just serve as a mediator to a neutral party sitting down between the two parties to find some common ground so that they can work out a settlement between the two of them. And only after that has not been productive do we move on to the next phase of what you might call arbitration or litigation of adjudicating the case. But even that, as Razam Nechemiah points out, can and should be done in a fashion where there are pshara considerations that are brought into consideration with respect to the final decision that is issued by the Beis Din.
That's a very complete and comprehensive picture of what pshara is able to accomplish. And I think it's very informative and also so reflective of the contributions that Rav Zalman Nechemiah made to Jewish life and Jewish learning and the halachic vision. And I thank you so much for bringing this article to the tradition readership and for doing so much in this conversation to bring out its important qualities and the wonderful attributes of Rav Zalman Nechemiah himself. I hope it should serve as a testament to his memory and as a continuation to his legacy, particularly within our community, and everything that we can learn from in order to move that forward and to more accurately realize that in our lives, in our community.
May we always be inspired and guided by his example. Thank you very much.
Amen. Thank you.